if you can make the championship series here, you can make it anywhere. We have another team moving on, and they are also in New York. We will talk about the Yankees knocking out the Royals, the Gardos and the Gritty Tigers battling it out in a sensational game in the D. And look ahead to game five between, as my wife says, the Pads and the Lads, as in L-A-D.
I was like, are you going to say the Pods and the Dods? But the Pads and the Lads is great.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that also would have been gone if it was at Yankee Stadium. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And that wall's pretty close there, but not in Kansas City.
Kyle Isbell must demand a trade to New York as soon as possible. As, I was watching those highlights thinking, wow, that wall just looks really far away. In KC, we are going to begin this Friday edition of Baseball Barbacast, recapping a DS clinching victory for the Yankees of New York as the AL Central is down to just two teams. I was, of course, in attendance for Tigers Guardians. We'll get to that later. But because the Yankees are advancing, you are not in Kansas City. You are still in New York. We will begin with the team that we know for sure will continue on this season. Jake, tell me what happened in this here game four and why the Yankees ended up victorious over the Royals of Kansas City.
They may call them the Bronx Bombers, but they should call them the Uptown Hurlers. Sorry, that's terrible. The Yankees won this series and this game because of their pitching. Gerrit Cole, who was pretty blah in game one, was sensational last night. He leaned heavily on his fastball, throwing it more often than in any other start this season. The slider, which he used a lot in game one and it got crushed, did not throw it. Just like did not throw a slider the entire night, which is very interesting. And he was great. The Yankees scored three runs on the evening. One in the first, I believe one in the fifth and one in the sixth, all on timely singles. Aaron Judge hit a ball 115.5 miles an hour, the second hardest ball of his playoff career. Went one for two with two walks. And the Yankees were up 3-0, heading to the bottom of the sixth. And it was like, oh, well, that's right. That makes sense. Their bullpen had literally not allowed a run and still has not allowed a run this entire postseason in four of those games. But then in the bottom of the sixth, we got a little bit of spice. We have a double play with Michael Garcia sliding into second base into Anthony Volpe. This was not particularly clean. This is like when you're a kid and your parents are like, you clean your room. You're like, I cleaned it. It was clean. It's clean. But then they look at it. You're like, that's not clean. It's not clean. Just was it clean from Garcia? That's okay. He and Volpe kind of get into it a little bit. Garcia lingers a little bit longer than he should have. I think he was looking for trouble to kind of get the engine rolling for the Royals. And when there is spice, like a fly to a light, Jazz Chisholm, the one and only, finds his way into the fray. He starts chirping at Garcia. They go back and forth. The bench is clear. Nothing resembling a punch is even thought about, let alone thrown. Everyone returns to their homes. The next batter, Bobby Witt Jr., hits a single down the line. Vinny Pasquantino comes up and crushes one to the gap to score. Witt to make the score 3-1. And all of a sudden, Salvador Perez is up at the dish with the tying run in the sixth inning. I get a text from friend of the show, Mike Farron. Every day, we text one another, key moment of the game. Or as it is in Dominican Winter League parlance, key moment of the game. And Salvador Perez popped out to end the threat. But in the seventh, Cole comes back out. Tommy Pham, two out single. Pham was 3-for-3 against Cole, which is hilarious. And maybe like, not single-handedly, but helped to earn him a contract next year. Like, I feel like if you go 3-for-3 in an elimination game off Gerrit Cole, it's like, yeah, you got to get a job somewhere, right? So he gets a two out single, and that brings up Kyle Isbell. Isbell cranks one. Fastball inside, maybe the worst spotted fastball Cole had on the night in a big spot. got a little bit too much plate. Isbell hits it to the track. Soto catches it. It would have been gone, I think, at 26 different parks. Fortunately for the Yankees, Kauffman Stadium is a savanna. It goes on forever. And so it was an out, and the Yankees hold on to win. Clay Holmes and Luke Weaver shut it down in the eighth and the ninth, and that was that.
So, I mean, the fact that this Yankees bullpen, as you mentioned, has been so flawless in a postseason where, as I mentioned yesterday, and as we'll talk about again when we get to the Guardians and Tigers, everyone's getting got here. And odds are it'll happen at some point for Luke Weaver and Clay Holmes even. Of course, we've seen that over the course of the regular season. But you just have to give this Yankees pitching staff credit. And Luke Weaver in particular, you know, emerging as this relief ace is really something to behold, both from a personality perspective, but also from a, you know, just career trajectory perspective. I mean, to me, the comp recently is Seawald, just from the standpoint of like, this guy was just a bad starting pitcher and now he's an amazing reliever. But Weaver had a lot longer time starting. This was a former first round pick. This is a guy who I just watched last year make a bunch of bad starts for the Reds. This guy has just hasn't quite worked. But as you've mentioned many times, having been around the Yankees over the last few years, they know what to do with these guys. And boy, oh boy, has he just become this incredible piece in a way that has now allowed Clay Holmes to really settle in and also have a lot of success in his non-closing role. So you just have to give it a ton of credit. And of course, Cole, I'm glad you mentioned that. I think one of my favorite things in any baseball postseason is the pitcher facing a team for a second time in the same series. We'll see it again with Skubal on Saturday against Cleveland, and maybe we'll see Matt Boyd. We saw it with Bybee, you know, in game four. How they attack them in the same postseason series is always really interesting. And for Cole to give seven innings there, and what was so interesting, I was going to mention that last pitch to Isbell was his worst located, but it was also only his 87th pitch. I mean, think about how efficient he had been. I was going to say, oh, was his pitch count up really high? Maybe it was like, no, he was still cruising. Pitch count-wise, he probably could have kept going, but obviously because of how good Holmes and Weaver had been, there was no reason to let them do that.
Yeah, and you don't want to send him back out for what would have been the top of the order. Isbell, the eight-hole hitter, Garcia saw him decently well. Just didn't make sense to send him back out. Yankees, again, I just want to say this, zero earned runs in 15 and two-thirds innings. Okay, that's wild. Jordan, let's actually quickly talk about bullpen stuff. What do you think reliever ERA is for these playoffs as a whole? Every team combined that doesn't totally exemplify what we're talking about. Obviously, there's a lot of instances where it's low leverage, whatever. What do you think the reliever ERA is league-wide for October? 217 innings so far.
Man, that's good. So this is interesting because have they thrown more innings than the starters? Probably not yet. I mean, this is something we've been tracking, is just the percentage of innings thrown by relievers has just gone up every year in the postseason.
Starters have thrown 222 innings. Relievers have thrown 217 innings. So it's
okay. All right. So it's there. You go. Okay. So you're asking me what the league ERA is, and this is including yesterday. I would assume it's higher than normal, but maybe not.
I mean, higher than normal. I don't have like reliever ERA for the whole season in front of me. But okay. I guess I'm asking what's higher, reliever ERA or starter ERA?
Ooh, I think I would say I spent some good bullpen games. That's the thing. I feel like you're leading me towards it's not as high as you would think, despite the Phillies bullpen ERA being like 25 collectively.
Starter ERA is 3.72. Reliever ERA is 3.19, which is really low, like really good. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Now, every team's worst relievers are barely throwing. And the relievers that bring reliever ERA up during the regular season are just not around. Right. They're just not on the team right now. Mm-hmm. And so it is lower than I think you'd realize. But it is a 4.12 FIP. So maybe it gets worse.
Well, I would also just say that runs allowed by relievers carry more weight. Late in games, those runs not only is the leverage obviously higher, but they just feel bigger. And so that is part of the perception of it versus all the success we have obviously seen teams have with bullpen games, as the Dodgers just delivered an entire game of this, you know, the other day.
And please, Jordan, the Phillies bullpen ERA in the playoffs is 11.37. Okay.
Oh, I apologize. That was disrespectful.
Last thing. Do you know who has the lowest team ERA in October?
The lowest team ERA. I mean, it's the Yankees.
Your Baltimore Orioles, baby. 1-5-0 in 18 innings.
We ain't given like a 3-game minimum.
No siree. All right. Let's just hop back to the Yankees here.
Do you want to do you want to say goodbye to the Royals, or do we want to talk about the Yankees?
I want to talk about Jazz. So they have that little kerfuffle in the sixth inning where Garcia slides in a Volpe. And as is the Yankee playbook, Volpe de-escalates the situation immediately. And when asked about it, Volpe says, quote, "Those things are hard." This is via MLB.com. "Those things are hard. Everyone is playing hard. Everyone's trying to win. They're playing for their season. He went in hard, but you're always going to stand up for yourself." Yes, Anthony. Yes. Jazz is asked about it too.
Yeah, well, okay. Before we get to Jazz's quote, I just want to say that in the moment, people kind of remarked, and Volpe does say you have to stand up for yourself, but the pats on the back after the slide, multiple, right? It wasn't just like right after he popped up, but the like almost kind of sassy pat on the back, like nice try, not sassy, buddy.
Not sassy in Volpe's mind. So this is what I like about this, okay?
Okay.
Good boy Anthony Volpe is genuinely trying to de-escalate the situation. Like, that is his intention.
During the slide. You might be right. You might
when
be
he
right.
I felt like back, it was a 100%.
Couple, I feel like it was a couple additional touches.
No.
That seemed a little just a modicum.
Again, I'm not saying Volpe is innocent here. His inability to recognize that those additional touches would be perceived as too much shows a lack of feel here. But in his mind, I guarantee you, having talked to this guy many times,
he is
not trying to like patronize Mikel Garcia.
Sure.
He is simply totally trying to get him off the field. And because what Volpe is saying is, Garcia, you clearly did a bad slide. And when you see the play, just to mention this, he slides into Volpe's elbow. And like when Volpe tries to tag him, like he does, Volpe's forearm does hit him kind of up towards the head, but it's totally unintentional. But Volpe is saying, a little weird slide, I don't care, play a playoff game, play it hard, get off the field, right? Mm-hmm. Jazz hops it. And Garcia lingers, I think, a little longer than he should have, and that's why Jazz hops it. And this is Jazz's quote, is so good. Quote, "I just felt like he tried to go and injure Volpe because he was being a sore loser. He was talking a lot on Instagram and Twitter and stuff. I do the same thing. But I'm not going to go and try and injure someone if they're winning a game. I didn't like that. So I told him, we don't do that on this side. I'm always going to stick up for my guys." Yes. Thank you. Here's why Jazz is a great Yankee. Maybe the best Yankee ever. Okay. He says what's actually happening. Every other Yankee basically ever is just reaching into their bag of cliche and just handing you whatever they find. Jazz is like, here is exactly what happened. And thank you. Yes. A little bit of transparency goes a long way. And it's very refreshing. And all of the Yankees fans, including our producer, Andrew Hartz, who were concerned about Jazz saying they got lucky after game two, none of those people are mad at him now. Okay? So just remember that. That's all I got to say.
Yeah, I mean, again, Jazz is just in a perfect position here to play this role, because he has a cast around him, and it's not like he hasn't contributed to this team, obviously, right? But this version of Jazz is so perfect. I mean, we're going to probably love it in all contexts, but on a team that is capable of handling its business and just winning a lot, it's delightful that you have this guy who's like, yeah, we're gonna win the World Series. Yeah, this is exactly how I feel. This is exactly what happened. And that's, nothing's gonna change. And you have, you know, in the celebration after, everybody's his teammates are booing him because the Royals fans are booing him. It's all great. And I'm excited that we get more Jazz here. It's a wonderful thing.
Let's say goodbye to the Kansas City Royals, who, remember, okay, they lost 106 games last year and were two away from the ALCS. It is an amazing accomplishment. They are not satisfied, nor should they be. Why'd they lose this series? A couple of reasons. Bobby Witt Jr. chased too much and wasn't great in this series. He did not have an extra base hit. He had five singles. Not five singles. He, I believe, had two hits in this series. Vinny was not particularly great either before he had his big swing. And the lineup just wasn't good enough otherwise. And
yeah.
It's really that simple. I mean, Vinny, that was the only hit Vinny had all series, was the double in game four. Understandable, considering his hand looks like the Michelin man's stomach. Considering he broke a finger. But yeah, I mean, like, Salvi had three hits, 3 for 16. Bobby Witt, 2 for 17. Vinny, 1 for 16. Melendez, 2 for 13. Like, this team is not good enough offensively at the bottom for the guys at the top to go quiet like that.
Let alone against a pitching performance that the Yankees delivered. I mean, on paper, this is where, even in a short series, if the better team executes, I mean, this is what we saw with the Royals coming into the postseason with how bad their offense was in September. And if they were going to get past, if they were going to pull another upset, it was going to take their best players to deliver more than they did. Now, bigger picture, it's an incredible year, right? And I think that what they accomplished, what they proved, particularly with how much better they got on the mound, and how, not just, of course, the guys that they had kind of brought up, but the guys that they had got out and brought in addition to the internal guys that had kind of taken steps forward, the trades that they made, the signings that they made. So much rent, you know, went really right here. But, you know, this is a bigger picture thing that I'm sure we'll talk about with Detroit and Cleveland, whoever gets eliminated here. Is this is, you know, the AL Central, it's going to be a different time in the AL Central. And Bobby Witt kind of talked about this after the game, but they're all going to say, okay, now we're here to stay. And we'll see. Cause it's, they proved a lot this year. And I was so impressed when I saw them in person in Cleveland earlier this year. Like, this was a really, really cool season. And I think there's going to be reasons to be excited about them moving forward. But as we'll see with Detroit too, and as we'll talk about it, you need a lot of really good players eventually to make a statement here. There's a reason the Yankees and Mets have advanced. There's a reason the Dodgers and Padres, one of them, will advance tonight. And the depth was unfortunately kind of apparent once we kind of got to this stage.
And for the Yankees, they will play game one of the ALCS at the stadium on Monday. Carlos Rodon will start that game. Gerrit Cole will start game two. Their opponent, we still don't know. And so now we will take a break. And when we return, Jordan will hold our hand and guide us through yet another banger in the AL Central semifinals. Baseball Barbercast, Jake Mintz, George Schusterman. ALDS game four. There were two of them last night. And Jordan was at the one in Detroit. Tigers on the brink. Guardians also on the brink. When we say brink, there's good brinks and bad brinks. You know, as long as it's an elimination game for someone, someone is on some type of brink. The Tigers needed a win to go to the ALCS. The Guardians, if they did not win, they would be going home to Cleveland, which rocks. And we had Tanner Bibee on the mound, who started game one for the Guardos. Tigers sent Reese Olson out there just as a regular starter. They didn't get cute with it. Both pitchers were shaky, but got the job done in the early going. The Guardians score first in the top of the first, and Lane Thomas RBI single, their first run after 20 scoreless innings.
Yeah. And by the way, just like quick thing here, I was like, thankfully, I didn't have to do too much thinking on this because they scored immediately. But if you're wondering if a team has ever been shut out three consecutive times in the postseason, it has happened twice, but not since the 1966 World Series. So that was the history that the Guardians were thankfully not thinking about as they got three hits in the top of the first and Lane Thomas drove in the first round.
Bottom of the second, the Tigers respond. Tanner Bibee just could not locate his fastball for the first couple innings. He walks a couple hitters. And Trey Sweeney, sack fly to tie the game. But then you have a key moment here, which is a line out double play, which gets Bibee out of the inning. Fast forward, it's still 1-1. Fast forward, top of the fifth. Jose Ramirez stands up. Solo home run, 418 feet to left. No doubter. Even, you know what? I'll call it a no doubter. It was clear you could pronounce the B, his third career playoff home run.
Yeah, and he had been quiet over the previous few games. Tyler Holton is in the game at this point. We know he has been awesome. They turn Ramirez around to bat righty. And one of the sneaky subplots of you know, Jose's unbelievable season, he's always been incredible from both sides. That's why he's one of the best players in the world, is that he is a very balanced, productive switch hitter. But he has been unbelievable batting right-handed this year with like an OPS over 1,000, which again, he's normally pretty good, but historically he's had more seasons better batting lefty than righty. And this year, all of his biggest power, especially this was his hardest hit home run of the season. This was, and this is the thing, Jose Ramirez doesn't hit a lot of no doubters, as you just said, right? He's most of the time he hits them just far enough, and that's what makes
him
amazing.
The Derby?
You know? Exactly.
The Derby was like, is that going to go? Yes.
But you know what? That's different than when Mookie Betts did the Derby. He just literally couldn't hit home runs. Like, Jose can hit the home runs when he wants to, but they aren't normally obvious. This one, just immediately, he gives a big home run. And then you're like, okay, there it is. Like, Cleveland has this moment. This is the finally Jose Ramirez shows up. And then in the bottom of the fifth, immediately, how are the Tigers going to respond? With a Zach McKinstry homer. And that was kind of just how this series has felt, where it's like, it doesn't matter what Cleveland tries. Their best players can show up or not show up. And Detroit is just going to conjure something up. Zach McKinstry, only 4 home runs all season. He was their 26th man for much of the season. This guy pitched 3 times in the first, you know, few months of the season. He played a bunch of different positions. He was playing short before Baez got hurt and Sweeney became the shortstop. He's been all over the place. But Hinch said before the game, like, I liked him against Bibee. And there he goes. He takes Bibee deep. And then that's the end of Tanner Bibee's game.
If we were playing baseball Pokemon and you played Jose Ramirez and I played Zach McKinstry, right? It would, you'd win. You'd win. You would just win. This was also Stephen Vogt trying to get, maybe being a little too cute with Bibee, where trying to squeeze out maybe one more inning out of him. He had really settled in the third and the fourth. He had Cade Smith, who is automatic for 3 outs whenever he wants. He had him warming and ready. Didn't go to him. McKinstry pops. Bibee, that's his last pitch. In comes Cade Smith. And Cade Smith in that inning is like, boing, boing, boing.
Well,
see ya.
Well, and this He's is so this good, is the dude. Thing, right? This is the thing, is your point about Vogt and Bibee is fair, but even worst case scenario, you're expecting McKinstry to maybe line one up the middle. You know, you're not like, McKinstry is not a game tying home run threat, no matter what the matchup is. So
you did not have McKinstry Oppo Bomb on the bingo card.
Exactly. So to your point, though, Cade Smith, who has been automatic, comes in, gets 3 outs quickly. He's unbelievable. Top of the sixth, Holden goes back out there. He goes 1-2-3. And then Smith comes back out for the sixth. And Kerry Carpenter, we know Kerry Carpenter. What does he do? Well, he hits right-handers well. He gets a single. Cade Smith strikes out Veeling, but then Riley Green walks. And this was the first time since August 30th that Cade Smith had allowed multiple base runners in an outing. Now, it was subtle, right? It didn't feel like they were crushing him, but that's how good he had been. And this also sets up the Tigers take the lead. Hunter Gaddis comes in. He strikes out Colt Keith. Well, Wenzel just Perez.
Quickly. Mm-hmm. He walks Riley Green on 4 pitches. I mean, that's the thing. I think if it's a longer at bat or it's more competitive, he maybe stays in the game. It was just 4 fastballs, all were below the zone. His control was gone.
Yep.
He just missed, and so they, he's
been,
got him.
He had pitched again. He's pitched in every single one of these games. Like he's, they have been using him, and he has been amazing. But this sets up, you know, Detroit taking the lead here as Wenzel Perez pinch hits for Spencer Torkelson and just kind of bloops one over the shortstop for the lead. Wenzel Perez, the longest tenured member of the Tigers organization, having signed in July of 2016 as a 16-year-old. He's just been around forever. He debuted this year. Obviously, another one of their versatile guys who came up as a shortstop, switch hitter, and now he's been mostly an outfielder. But a really cool moment for him there to take the lead, and in a moment that unfortunately will maybe not be remembered as much as we expected.
You know, we want to try and get pronunciations right, but the fact that it's W-E-N-C-E-E-L and is pronounced Wenzel or Wenzel not Wenzel. That's a tough one.
Especially, I know. It's like the first time you see that name, that spelling, and you think you know it. It's not like, you know, there's some other names that are, you see multiple versions of them and they're pronounced different ways. Like, I don't know how many Wenzels there are. But anyway, he is a delightful player and he
Stephen
has
A. Smith
a delightful
is
moment there. Yeah.
Butcher that when the Tigers win the World Series. Wenzel Perez.
Yeah. We'll say, hey. If we could get to the point where Stephen A. Smith is saying his name in any way, that's probably a dub for the Tigers of Detroit. Anyway, Tigers take the lead. And now, because of all of these pitchers, and sure, they'd had as good as this pitching staff has been, they had faltered at times, but you're 9 outs away. You're 9 outs away. It's not like the Cleveland offense has been, you know, overwhelming. And so we're counting down the outs. Like, we're ready to roll here. In comes Sean Gunther for the bottom of the order and another lefty replacing Holton. It's for Naylor, Rocchio, and Quan are scheduled. They pinch hit John Kenzie Noel, who grounds out. Rocchio flies out. So quick 2 outs. All right, we're 7 outs away. And Stephen Kwan, man. Oh, again, Stephen Kwan, who was not very good in the second half and then was injured and came back at the very, very end of the regular season. He had missed time. He just was not looking quite the same. But boy, he's now has consecutive three-hit games for them. And he's a machine. He's hitting like .330 against left-handed pitching this year. I think it's just outrageous. And he gets a 2-out single. Which brings up an interesting moment because the lefty Sean Gunther is still on the mound. The rookie lefty hitting Kyle Manzardo is scheduled to bat. And, you know, Stephen Vogt decides to pinch hit David Fry. You know, sure, it looks like he wants it to face Gunther, but he knows that Hinch is going to counter.
You're choosing between your righty against their righty or your lefty against their lefty if you're the offensive manager here. And he goes with your righty against their righty. So in goes David Fry. In goes Bo Brisky, and out goes the baseball.
Yes. And while, right, on paper, so much about this matchup was a bad one. Brisky had not allowed a hit in the postseason. Fry was 0 for 3 with 3 strikeouts against Brisky this season. David Fry, I mean, just in general, over the last few months, has not been nearly as productive as he was over the first 2 months when he was one of the best hitters in baseball. He has been dealing with an elbow injury, which is why you haven't seen him catching at all. He has not played a lot of defense because he has been dealing with that, but he's still been hitting. He's been pinch hitting. He's been DHing mostly against left-handers. But there's one thing that David Fry has done well this year, and this is what I ended up writing about because it's just kind of a mind-blowing thing, and sample size or not, he's had success. No hitter in baseball has a higher OPS this season after falling down 0-2 than David Fry. And so sure enough, here he goes, falls down 0-2. And you're like, well, this is unfortunate for David Fry. He was not worried about it. And he gets it back to 2-2. And then just again, this is not the best pitch location here for Risky Brisky. And he just destroys it to left. And the Guardians dugout is just, I mean, Naylor chucked the bat. He was in the hole. He chucked the bat higher than you most bat flips you've ever seen. And it was incredible. I mean, it was like, and yes, you still felt like the Tigers had another rally in them. And they kind of did. We can kind of wrap up the rest of the game. But that was just a singular swing. And for how good Brisky had been, it was really, really, really something for David Fry in an amazing season for David Fry.
And remember, you can mix and you can match. You can try and get your platoon advantages all you want, but sometimes baseball just freaking happens, right? And so exactly. David Fry, like yep. You could argue that Hinch, specifically as it pertains to pinch hitters and the matchups there, outmanaged Stephen Vogt again. Like he did. David Fry just went yard. And so it's just, you just throw your hands up if you're Hinch. Okay, yep. Top eight, outrageous Colt Keith play. The yeah. Guardians have a runner on second base, ball hit in the hole by second, and Keith goes full extension, throws to Matt Vierling at first. Matt Vierling, who played two innings at first base this year, was caught in no man's land. That was adorable.
Yes. Let's mention this. I mean, there was a lot of moves going on, but one of the things that happened that's very important, especially as we look towards game five, is that Kerry Carpenter left the game after scoring on that Perez hit. Kerry Carpenter left the game with a, I guess, lower body hamstring situation injury that I don't have an update as we record this on Friday morning, but that he was not in the game anymore. And obviously if he is not available on Saturday, that is a pretty gigantic deal. And because of the machinations of all the moves that Hinch was being forced to make, Matt Vierling was playing first base, which he not normally was. And Colt Keith, who is of course not his progress on defense over the course of the season has been very impressive, but that was a play that felt like, all right, okay, they're not going to go quietly here. And we go to the eighth, and when Riley Green, you know, leaps off the single, and Wenzel Perez gets another hit, all right, Clase, time for redemption.
Now, Clase comes in, I believe, with one out or no outs?
One out.
And the big home run he allowed in game two to Kerry Carpenter was on a slider, not just on a slider, but on the third consecutive slider. Now, the difference between this outing for Class A and that one is that behind the dish was Austin Hedges, who has a bat like a pool noodle, but a brain, a catching brain like a genius. And Class A just leans on the heat, leans on the cutter. Does not throw
he threw one slider in the outing in the ninth to Malloy, but other than that I think it was, I don't know how many exact pitches, but yeah, I think it was only one slider. I asked Hedges after the game about it. I was like, that seemed like you were going to the cutter, and he was just like, yeah, everybody panicked after he hit it, you know, after he gives up a home run, but of course we're doing that. So I mean, yeah, it was like, it was so obvious that it was like, oh yes, This is really what it's supposed to look like. And I got to say, credit to Trey Sweeney, who got a hit off Clase in that, you know, game two, and, you know, fouled a couple off here. Like he and it was up in the kitchen, and this rookie who had never seen him before, it was an impressive battle. He strikes out to end the eighth, but the top of the ninth becomes very important too, because We get Kwan, Rocchio and Kwan get on. Anything else in the eighth? Because I just think that the ninth ends up being very important.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say, Rocchio and Kwan get on, and you end up with a David Fry safety squeeze to give them a cushion insurance run. Gardo's baseball. This is Guardians baseball, right? Is manufacturing runs out of very, very little. Awesome moment, small ball on a night where they scored three runs on homers. Maybe the most important run the Guardians end up scoring comes on a safety squeeze, and we move to the ninth inning. Out comes Clase for a second frame, the fourth time all season he did an up down, and the second in the playoffs. Justin Henry Malloy leads off with a double. A cutter gets too much of the dish, and Malloy gets his barrel there for a double down the left field line. He moves to third on a Parker Meadows ground out. He scores on another ground out, Chase Young. And so it is a one-run game, 5-4. Matt Vierling up as the tying run against Class A. And that is a tough assignment for Matty V. Matty V, who I went back and watched his at-bats this morning. He just like, some nights when you're facing good pitching, you're just like, well, yeah, I went over three with 3 Ks or whatever. Like, he was just getting obliterated by elite execution. And that is the case, is what happens in the ninth.
Right. Class A. The one thing I would just say is like, you know, this is why I mentioned Carpenter earlier, right? We would have had a rematch of Carpenter and Clase, but because he had gotten injured, it's the rookie Jace Young. And that was, by the way, Jace Young's first at bat of the postseason, I believe. So again, speaking of tough assignments, the fact that they managed to score against him again is also amazing, right? I mean, this is they now have scored four times against Clase, and Clase allowed five runs all regular season. But that extra run in the top of the ninth, that was the ultimate insurance run. And you know, he sits down Matty V, and that's that.
And now we head to game five. Guardians, congratulations. You kept the series going. As a gift, you get Tarek Skubal.
Yeah, but hey, they wouldn't have it any other way. This is just an incredible opportunity for Skubal. We don't know exactly who's starting for Cleveland. Of course, it was Matt Boyd in game two. It would make some sense to at least start with Boyd. It's, again, they have all these other relievers. Maybe you just go an interesting sequence of relievers from the jump. I'm not exactly sure. We'll probably get some clarification on that at some point. But for Skubal, man, I mean, he has just delivered basically for four or five consecutive outings when the Tigers have needed him. And this will be another, also back in Cleveland, right? Of course, it would have been cool to see Skubal pitch at home, but with his interaction with the Cleveland crowd, with his dominance in game two, I think that'll be very, very cool to see as well.
The Yankees are the big winner here because Skubal,
if
the Tigers win, now wouldn't pitch until game three, which would be in Detroit. So that would be very cool to see.
Yes. Yes.
All right.
Yes. But so that'll be, I'll be there. It will really be, really, I am very excited. Cleveland, I mean, you know, we shouldn't be that surprised. Of course, this has been a very, very successful team all season. And Detroit, as we saw, you know, offensively also, you know, has some limitations. But it'll be, we've had some classics already in the series. And I hope that Saturday is no different.
All right, let's take a break. When we get back, we'll touch on a couple things. Previewing Padres-Dodgers Game 5. Welcome back to the end of Baseball Barbercast. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman. I am in New York. It is crisp this morning. But the Mets have no interest in that because the Mets are heading to California, no matter whom they play for the NLCS, whether it is the Dodgers or the Padres, or as I said, my wife says, Lad versus Pads, they will play tonight on Yom Kippur in Los Angeles. And what could be more appropriate for a Kol Nidre showdown than Yu Darvish versus Yoshinobu Yamamoto, the first matchup in postseason history between two Japanese-born starting pitchers, that stat via the one and only Sarah Langs. It will be a gem in LA.
Will Yu Darvish atone for what happened the last time he pitched in an elimination game at Dodger Stadium?
The book of life will close.
It would be pretty freaking cool. I know when we talked yesterday about the opportunity for Darvish having already dominated the Dodgers in this series. But yes, when you zoom out for the larger context in his career, we don't have to relitigate everything that happened that season so long ago. But honestly, today, as we talk about this briefly, because again, by the time you're listening to this, the game will be starting here not too long from now. I mean, Yamamoto, man, like, this is it, man. This is go do the thing. I have been convinced. I have watched this guy this season for how much we've talked about him when they gave him the biggest pitcher ever given to a free agent starting pitcher. But he's still so young, right? Like, he is a rookie. He is a major league rookie, right? And this is an incredibly high stakes space for him to appear in this game. Now, the reality is it will probably be a short leash for a lot of reasons. But if he's cruising and he can dominate for even four or five innings, that will go a long way towards, you know, making his first season with the Dodgers feel like a success. Because as we know, with how much this pitching staff has been decimated by injury, he is one of the guys left standing, and he has the talent to make a significant difference in this game. And so that is what I'm really thinking about here.
The stuff is not the question for him. It's the execution. There were some whispers that maybe he was tipping some pitches during his game one start. We'll see if there's any obvious changes here tonight in game five. Great point and joke and tweet from our producer, Andrew Hartz, who said that the Mets should go to the game tonight. The Mets, who I would just fly to Orange County and then bus either up or down so you can get adjusted to the time zone and enjoy the weather. The Mets should just go sit at the game tonight in a big group in the stands like it's a D3 baseball tournament.
They 100% should. And, you know, teams are sending you, I'm sure you've noticed this, there's all kinds of advanced scouts in the postseason that you see. Teams are sending their pro scouts to go get an eye on them in case they face them in a future round or in the World Series. You know, I've seen Dodgers scouts at this Guardians Tigers series, right? So, but this would really be just delightful if you got, who would be the funniest person to be, you know, sitting behind home with a stopwatch and a radar gun? Who is the most scouty Met and who's the least scouty Met?
Okay, I would say one of the relievers is the most scouty, like Danny Young. Feels like, okay, so here you go. I ran into literally Brandon Duckworth, okay, who is now scouting for the Yankees at Citi Field. And it's like, that feels like Danny Young.
I was going to say,
that's,
I'll
a disservice
be honest.
To if, Brandon Duckworth.
I'll be honest, if Danny Young was, you know, here at Detroit scouting I might not notice, respectfully. so maybe that would be cool. What about the other side? Who would be the
Tyrone Taylor would also kind of fit in as a scout. He kind of, yeah, he's kind of a lower key guy. The least scout guy on the team would have to just be like Pete. Like, it just,
I think more Vientos than Pete. But yeah, they're Vientos. Both both be really, really,
it's
funny.
So funny to think about. Yeah, one quick Mets thing, which is, yeah, Jeff McNeil, yeah, who missed a bunch of time and got hurt, hasn't played in a couple months, month and a half, I think. He's headed to the Arizona Fall League to get some reps, which is kind of wild. The Fall League, which is for prospects, it's the third time a rehabbing injured big leaguer has been allowed, given a special dispensation, to play in that league. Kyle Schwarber 2016 and Tyler O'Neill in 2022, and didn't end up playing for the Cardinals. Schwarber one obviously is a lot more famous. The thing with McNeil is, like, should he be on the roster? Like, there's a legitimate question because he just hasn't seen live pitching. He would be taking Luis Angel Acuna's spot if he were to be on the roster as kind of the bench infielder. But, like, you gotta play Iglesias every day, and you're obviously not moving Lindor. You could think about McNeil getting some outfield reps, maybe against a right-handed pitcher,
well,
over Starling Marte, but Marte's kind of become a everyday cog now that he's been playing better, and you can't really put any of these guys in center field. And so it creates an interesting log jam there. I just, maybe you DH him against a righty.
Well, not with Winker. I mean, this is the thing. They only have, I mean, Lindor switch hitter, but the only other lefties on the roster right now are Nimmo and Winker. The challenge, you know, at his best, you know, Winker's crushing righties. So I have to imagine it's about giving them a left-handed bat off the bench in some form. But the fact that his defense is obviously not particularly impactful, and because of how good Iglesias has been playing, it is going to be interesting if he actually makes this roster. I understand them giving him the opportunity to try, but I don't know if it's a guarantee that he would be end up back. But I think the fact that he is left-handed is pretty much the whole thing, and could at least provide them a matchup, even if he isn't going to start in most of the games. But we'll see.
All right, that's it. Enjoy dad's lads and the pads.
Yes. We will be back on Sunday evening to preview the ALCS and review game one of the NLCS. So we are not, because of the Kipper, we are not going to be hopping on to record a full, you know, NLCS preview before then. But we will be recapping that first game and recapping game five and looking ahead to game five of the CS of the ALC, ALDS, excuse me. And what happens with Scooble against Cleveland. We will be talking about that also on Sunday night. But until then, thank you all for listening. And I mean, two game fives. Enjoy, folks. We will talk to you very soon. Thank you to producer Andrew Hartz. As always, you can email us at baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. Goodbye.